Dave from New Jersey. It's the SNL nerds. I'm going to take that again because it came out weird. Dave from New Jersey. It's the SNL nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
Hey, Darren, how you doing?
I'm doing well, sir. Doing well. Just, you know, we're just coming off that big, monstrous, behemoth 3-hour episode we put out last week.
I think we are somehow still recording last week's episode. Yeah. That went on for so long. And thank you if you listened to the entire thing. I hope we were interesting throughout.
Yeah, we had a lot to say, had a lot of thoughts.
We had a lot to say. We will definitely try to keep it shorter next year. We've already discussed ways we can do that because, we don't usually like to go that long.
Right, but I mean, sometimes they go long. Yay, we can't control this beast that is SNL nerds, people.
It's three people. We're talking about an entire season of television, and we also have that impulse of like, I'm going to do my top three, and then 16 honorable mentions, and we can get away from that a little bit. So
a little bit.
So, we're now in our summer format. We're going to be doing SNL movies for the summer and maybe beyond if the writer's strike ends up going on beyond that. We don't know yet.
Summer movies into fall movies into winter movies. Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, every summer when we do this, I get very used to us just talking about a new project each week. And then when SNL actually comes back in the fall, it's like, oh, right. Yeah, that's like ostensibly the normal format of this show. And
it's like, oh, yeah, we're doing the show thing. Yeah,
I remember when we did that. Oh, yeah, we have to get back to what is the topic of this show.
Right. Oh, we're going to get back on track now. OK,
right. Yeah. So but now we're in our summer format of just doing movies that star current and former SNL cast members. And this is a movie that I originally watched at least a year or two ago. And it was one of those where I'm just watching it. And then all of a sudden like, oh, hey, there's an SNL person.
Yeah.
Look at that. I did not know they would be in this thing.
Sometimes that will happen. It's just come out of nowhere.
Yeah. You just run into them randomly out in the wild. And this week we are doing the movie Becoming Bond from 2017, which is all about one time James Bond actor, George Lazenby, and the one time he played James Bond.
Yeah. Film was written and directed by Josh Greenbaum, who actually did two other movies that we talked about on this podcast. He directed Too Funny to Fail, The Life and Death of the Dana Carvey Show.
Oh, I really like that. I didn't realize that was him, too. Okay,
that
cool.
That was him. And he also directed Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar.
Oh.
Yeah, probably one of our most divisive episodes ever.
Usually we agree more than we disagree, and that is probably the one where we've disagreed on the most.
It was very Siskel and Ebert. It was... Ooh.
Yeah, but that was kind of fun.
And he's actually also directing the upcoming movie Strays with Will Ferrell and Will Forte and Jamie Foxx too.
You just sent me the trailer for that one, and yeah, I watched that, and it's an animated movie where they're doing voice roles. Not an animated movie. Well,
it's live action.
A lot of CGI animals.
Yeah, I think it's mostly live action, but yeah, like Will Ferrell voices the dog, and Jamie Foxx's voices the dog, and they're like stray dogs, and I think Will Forte plays like the abusive owner of one of the dogs, so the dogs try to get back at him. But it sounds cutesy, but it's also like rated R, so the dog's going to be cursing and stuff.
Oh, well, okay.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
So, yeah, this movie, it's about like a very interesting, I don't know if I want to say footnote in movie history, but I mean, it's a very interesting backstory. And I asked you yesterday after we agreed that we were going to do this movie, I was like, oh, by the way, have you ever seen On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is the movie where George Lazenby plays James Bond? And you said, no, I have not.
I'll admit right off the rip, like I'm more of a casual James Bond fan. Like, I'm not, I mean, you're way more of a James Bond fan than I am, but like, I'm one of those people who's like, I, I know the lore of James Bond. I know, you know, of, you know, I know like the little things of him, like Moneypenny and Q and how, you know, shaken, not stirred, martini. Like, I know the basics, like the, but as far as getting kind of deep into the weeds of the whole, you know, background of James Bond, I don't know that much. Like, I haven't seen a good, I've seen a few of the Sean Connery ones. I think maybe one of the Roger Moore ones. I've seen probably more of the Daniel Craig one, just because they're more recent. But like all the other stuff in the past, like I really haven't checked out that much.
So you didn't like go see them as a kid with your dad or anything like that? That wasn't like...
Yeah, no. Like I remember, my dad, I don't think my dad was into James Bond that much either, so he didn't really take me. It's like, I think the closest I almost came to seeing it was, I remember like during camp, like they took us, when I was a kid, I think they took everybody to see the movies one day, and like I think our choices were either to see, what was it? It was like the late 80s, and we could either see La Bamba or whatever James Bond movie was coming out around the
time. It would have been Living Daylights, because I think La Bamba was 1987.
Yeah, so it was like Living Daylights. So it was like, all right, kids, you can either see Living Daylights or La Bamba. And I think I chose La Bamba just because I was like, oh, Living Daylights, that sounds, you know, violent and dangerous. I'd rather see something fun about music. You know, little did I know, the movie ends in a fucking plane crash killing three of the biggest musicians at the time.
not the most feel good of movies.
Just a brother screaming Richie to the heavens over his dead brother, Richie. Like, oh, this doesn't make me feel good at all.
But the backstory on how George Lazenby came to play James Bond and how On Her Majesty's Secret Service turned out, it's a fascinating story, because just to give a little context for people who might not be Bond fans, and I am like a much more hardcore Bond fan. Yes. I've got like, you know, a box set of all the movies. I've seen all the movies multiple times. There might be a couple that I've only seen once, but
you've seen them all at least once.
At least once, right. Okay. And I mean, it was still Roger Moore when I was a kid, and then Timothy Dalton came in when I was like 15, and you know, it's so much fun to follow, and it's always so fun when they select a new James Bond, and I really loved Daniel Craig in the role, and
Pierce Brosnan
was all right. His movies weren't as good for me. I really like his first one, GoldenEye, but I'm much more of a Daniel Craig guy personally.
Okay. So is he your favorite out of all the Bonds? Or I guess
I would say my favorite is still Sean Connery. But Daniel Craig is way up there. And I like George Lazenby too. Okay. But when the Bond series started in the 1960s, it was a genuine phenomenon. It was like the Star Wars of its day. You know, like lines around the block, and Sean Connery, he did five Bond films. He did Dr. No, From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, and You Only Live Twice. And he just became more and more identified with the role with each one. And like the ad campaign for You Only Live Twice was literally built around the tagline, Sean Connery is James Bond.
Wow.
And so, but he got very fed up with the series because these would take months and months to shoot. And they were releasing like one Bond film a year. It was like 62, 63, 64, 65. They skipped a year or two in there, like, yeah, because You Only Live Twice came out in 67. But anyway, they were coming out very, very quickly. It wasn't like today where we've got like 3-4 years between movies.
Right.
And I don't think he was getting like raises as time went on, and he certainly wasn't getting like a cut of the profits.
Oh, so, shit. All right.
You know, he had Connery had problems with the producers.
Okay.
You know, he clashed with them, and he finally got fed up. And when he was shooting You Only Live Twice in Japan, he was like being followed by paparazzi everywhere. And, you know, that got on his last nerve. And so I think finally when he finished that one, he was like, that's it. I'm done. No more. Never again.
Oh, wow. Oh, so he left on bad terms then.
Yeah, no, he wasn't on the best of terms with the producers in particular. And the producers were like, well, we're not going to get a little thing like not having James Bond keep us from making more James Bond movies. Because there were like more Ian Fleming books to adapt.
Right. So, yeah, no, I get it. Like once that money starts rolling in, it's like studios are like, we're not, no, this keeps going forever.
Exactly. It was this huge franchise. So what they did, they launched this big, huge casting search. And it was like probably the biggest casting search in like Scarlett O'Hara and Gone with the Wind.
Right.
And there was like literally a Life magazine cover story where they had like the final five candidates, okay, and they kind of like traced them through the audition process. And then finally they picked this guy, George Lazenby, who was this guy from Australia who was mostly like a male model.
Yeah.
Beforehand. And before that was a car mechanic and then a car salesman. And then
I mean this movie Becoming Bond kind of starts off like pretty much just all that, just amazing story about how,
right,
like you said, like, oh yeah, he's a guy from Australia, no acting experience at all, no,
right,
no agent or no manager, or it seems like
we'll get into that. That's part of what that kind of plays into why he only played Bond the one time.
Okay.
Is he was getting some bad advice from his management. There was this guy named Ronan O'Reilly, I think his name is. And he was the guy behind what was that? It was that radio thing. They made a movie about it. It was the offshore radio station in England.
Oh, Pirate Radio?
Pirate Radio. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
And he was basically advising Lazenby, because it's like 1969.
Right.
And he's like, hey, look, it's like the hippie movement. It's like, you know, free love and all this. People aren't going to be interested in this conservative guy in a tuxedo anymore.
Oh.
And you can kind of see where they were coming from. Because like the other, like, Honor, Majesty, Secret Service did very well at the box office. I think it was like the second highest grossing movie of that year.
Right. Yeah. It didn't bomb.
Yeah, it didn't. It did make less money than You Only Live Twice, the last Connery one, but it did very well. It was like the second highest grossing movie, but the other movies that were hits that year were things like Easy Rider and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice and like, you know, more counterculture type stuff.
Right.
So you can kind of see where they thought maybe the Bond train was done.
Yeah, I guess people were thinking, oh, this seems like old-fashioned now. Maybe we gotta... It seems like the kids today like all the long hair and the beards. Maybe we should be going in that direction. But then again, you're sort of abandoning what made your character popular originally. You're just kind of
chasing a fad. I mean, if you go too far into that, he's really no longer Bond because... Bond's this upper-class snob, and he sleeps with lots of women. I mean,
that's always cool.
But other than that, he doesn't have too much in common with like the hippie movement and all that.
Yeah, so that's Austin Powers.
Yeah, exactly. So this movie, Becoming Bond, it kind of tells the story of George Lazenby and how his life sort of led him to James Bond. And it's this weird circuitous route he took there.
Yeah. That was an interesting format too. The way they had the real George Lazenby come out and like him telling a story. And then they kind of cut to sort of like a recreation of his life and whatnot. Like,
yeah, they do like reenactments of his stories. And it's sort of like, it's almost like drunk history in a way.
Yes, because very.
At times you see the guy playing young George Lazenby, he's like mouthing along to what present day George Lazenby is saying.
Yeah, it's very drunk history.
It's very drunk history. I mean, because they get a little humorous. They get a little whimsical. They get a little tongue in cheek with it.
Right. Absolutely.
And you get the feeling throughout that George is kind of padding his stories a little bit, I think.
You do. Well, I mean, the very first thing I noticed in this thing is like they have like that Winston Churchill quote
Yeah.
Saying, history will be kind to me, for I intend to write it.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's interesting. And then they have like the director ask him straight up off camera, is like, did all of this happen? Is this all real? And then he was like, well, he didn't say yes or no, but he said
like, if I was lying, how could I remember it all?
Yeah, which that's not an answer.
I mean, but you know, particularly for stories you tell over the course of decades, they grow in the telling.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if you don't mean to,
right?
It's everyone kind of builds up their own myth.
Yeah,
I feel like there's some of that going on with George Lazenby.
Yeah, it's like the Ringling Brothers, you know, thing. Like, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story or something like that.
Yeah, is that where that quote's from?
I thought so. Wasn't it from Ringling Brothers? Barnum?
If you say so, I've never looked it up, but so.
I could be. Listeners, call in. Am I pulling shit out of my ass, or is that from?
I don't know. But hey, if you're pulling shit out of your ass, this is the episode to do
it. That's right. This is it.
I mean, we start out, George Lazenby, he talks about how he was like a sickly child. He had surgery 67 times as a kid. He was left with half a kidney, and he was not expected to live past age 12.
Yikes. Yeah.
I mean, it is really amazing that he survived that.
Yeah, that is fantastic. I think they said he was like peeing into his kidneys as a baby. It's pretty, pretty heartbreaking stuff to hear.
Yeah, and so he hears that, he lives through that, and he survives all that, and then he just decides, I am just going to live life to the fullest and do whatever I want. And he talks about, he was not a great student, a bit of a juvenile delinquent. He stole a car when he was 6 years old.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. And like, he talked about how he was really not a great student, like you said. Like, he can never focus on the teacher. So he wanted to do things to like shake things up, like, I don't know, bring snakes and bats into school and just let them free in the hallways. Which, at first I thought, where do you find snakes and bats? And I was like, oh, it's Australia. They're just
Australia, yeah, yeah.
They're like squirrels out there. They're just around.
Well, they're at least more accessible than they are in, like, the suburban United States.
So. Yes, absolutely.
He talks about how when he was 15 years old, he lost his virginity to a 23-year-old woman.
Wow.
And we learned what dry rooting is, and he says, "Oh yeah, that's having sex with your clothes on. That's doing it with your clothes on." Like, the director just kind of asked him. He's like, "What's dry rooting?" And it's Australian slang. And there, you learn a little bit of Australian slang during this. So yeah, that's kind of fun.
Yeah. So if anybody is planning on going to Australia this summer, now you know how dry rooting means.
Put dry rooting on your to-do list. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He doesn't graduate high school because he wasn't a very good student, and he said he found this out like during the graduation ceremony. He's expecting to walk up and get a diploma or certificate of completion, and
yeah, that's great. Like, wouldn't the school call you or send you a letter?
Think,
yeah, I thought somebody'd be like, "Hey, what are you doing here? You're not graduating, no, today." Or something like that.
Are we doing the Crocodile Dundee accent throughout?
Yeah, right. I think I'm nailing it.
Just checking. Darren loves his accent work, folks.
I really do. It's my bread and butter. It's my heart and soul.
So he doesn't graduate high school, so he ends up, he gets a job as a car mechanic. After a little while of doing that, he looks over at the car salesman, and he's like, hey, the salesmen are making all the money. And they're going to talk up women and all this. They seem like they're having a lot more fun. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to start selling cars. And
yeah. And
he becomes a car salesman.
Yeah. And I think like at first he's like really terrible at it. Mm-hmm. So then he takes a course on how to sell cars. And like, I think the one, again, it's the same thing where he's not a good student, but he said like the one thing he took away from that is to listen, don't talk. So just, just like listen to whatever the other person's saying and agree, and then you're able to sell cars. And through that, he was able to sell, I think he sold like 30 cars a week or something.
He was saying 30 a month.
A month? Oh, okay.
Yeah,
a week.
Which would average out to about one a day, which,
okay.
You know, that's pretty good from what I understand.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, 30 a week, that does sound crazy. Now that I say it.
Yeah, yeah, that's a lot. I don't know if anyone has ever done that. I used to work at a car dealership, and that sounds like a lot.
George, you sold all the cars. You got nothing. There's an empty lot. Nothing.
Yeah, and of course, like, you know, as you're selling the cars, you're getting commissions on those. So, you know, the more you sell, the better you do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and they he talks about how he started listening to customers, and that there's like one customer who's just kind of talking his ear off, not really about the car or anything. He's just going, right. And then he just says, almost as an aside, he's like, "Oh yeah, and I'll take this car." And so anyway,
my wife. Yeah, I guess you almost become like a bartender at some point, where you just listen to people's problems.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. And so he did so well at the car salesman business. He was promoted to a used car salesman. He starts selling cars to all these important people, like ambassadors and stuff. And he's going to embassy parties,
fancy,
and things like that. So he's starting to move in a higher tier of society, society.
Move it up the ladder.
Yeah. Yeah, and he goes to one of these embassy parties, and he meets this young lady named Belinda,
mm-hmm.
who figures into this movie in a big, big way.
Yeah, that's kind of surprising. They talk about Belinda for a good chunk of the movie, like even before they talk about him getting the role of Bond. Like, yeah. I think Belinda, like, they talk about her for like 30 minutes of the movie is about her.
Yeah, like that. It's a good, I mean, we hear all the ups and downs of his relationship with Belinda. And this was obviously a major, major relationship in his life. And I would say a major regret in his life.
Yeah, and that's true. Yeah.
I mean, his wife is never mentioned by name, but we hear all about Belinda.
Yeah.
Because she's the one who got away.
I guess so, yeah. Because the way they introduced her, like, I did think that they would end up together, mm-hmm. and, like, you know, live happily ever after, you know, wife, kids, picket fence and all that jazz. But, you know, no, like midway through the movie, he was like, oh, yeah, like, I left her and I never came back. And then
I didn't see her for another 20 years.
Yeah, and, like she went off and got married and had kids. And like, yeah, like, I really fucked that up. I was like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, yeah. And he's being very frank about it and all that. And I have no idea if, you know, that woman is still around and all that, but I mean, it was something. Yeah. We get a lot of his life regrets in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was not expecting that.
Yeah. So yeah, he kind of talks about how he courts her. Like, she had a boyfriend at the time and didn't want to go out with him. And so George Lazenby, he finds out where she works. And he keeps calling her, and she finally agrees to go out with him just to get him off the phone.
That's right. So, fellas, take note. If a woman won't go out with you, find out where she works.
No, don't do that.
Don't do that. I'm joking,
of course. Take no for an answer, and listen to what the woman is saying.
That is one thing I did notice throughout this, where a lot of times where he's like, oh, yeah, I just kept going after her until I broke her will. I was like, dude, this might not be as romantic as you think it is.
Well, I think it was romantic for its day, because I think that's kind of what you did in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Back then. That was just kind of the world we lived in. So, yeah, I mean, you look at it from a 2023 perspective and you're just like, Yeah, and he said that, like, Belinda was trying to call him back to break the date, and he, like, literally told people, like, if she calls, I am not here, because he knew if he spoke to her, she would actually break the date, and he didn't want that to happen.
That's right. You can't break the date if you're not there.
Yeah. Which, I mean, on one hand, kind of crafty. On one hand, it's like, okay, George.
All right, man.
He talks about going to pick up Belinda for their first date. Her brother jumps in the front yard at the house.
You know, as you do.
As you do.
Some people greet you with a handshake. Other people tackle you to the front lawn.
And he goes into the house, and he discovers that her father knows the Prime Minister of Australia, who's just, like, sitting there chilling out in their living room.
Yeah, we find out that Belinda comes from money. Yeah, and
yeah,
her dad knows the prime minister.
Yeah, and George is so young and naive at first. He thinks he's just a dude who looks like the Prime Minister, and then he's like, "Oh, you have the same name as the Prime Minister too. That's a weird coincidence."
Yeah, he doesn't put two and two together until a little bit later.
Yeah, yeah. And then it is kind of funny that, you know, George is telling a lot of these stories in the context of, you know, well, this is how young and naive and stupid I was.
Right.
So, you know, there is a bit of that distance that age gives you.
Absolutely. And then they also, as they go out, like, he takes her swimming on a first date. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah. But then she actually goes, like, they go by the river, but then she actually goes into the river going swimming. But then he kind of reels, oh, I didn't know, like, you'd actually want to go swimming. I just kind of wanted to take you out here to make out and stuff, I believe.
Right? Yeah, yeah. She kind of called his bluff, it seemed like. You know,
yeah,
just,
a little bit.
They're just going swimming in their underwear. And I guess he was using the swimming as a pretext to, you know, get something.
Yeah, to get something
get
going.
Get something going sexually.
Mm.
But Belinda seems to come around and like him. And they start going out and she becomes his girlfriend.
Much to her father's chagrin.
Yeah. And because her father does not approve of this, he sends Belinda to England. And then George, he actually gets on a sailing ship to follow her to England.
Right. Because
they were going to be separated for like 3 months, I think he said.
Something like that. But yeah, but then like she starts writing him every day, like she's out there. But then mm-hmm. the more she's out there, the fewer or more infrequent the letters get to one day.
Right.
He doesn't get a letter at all. So that's when
he was getting like 5 letters a day, then 4, then 3, and then
right.
Yeah, gradually none at all.
Then he's like, oh, what's this all about?
Yeah. Yeah. And then he follows her to England. He can't really find her when he gets to England. He goes to her place and she's not there and he's kind of waiting around and he ends up getting like a little hole in the wall room.
Right, right. And then like he goes into a bar just to drink away his troubles. And then I think he said one of his old friends from back home is like, oh, yes, I saw in a bar right down the street.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
And at this point, he walks in, he sees her with her new boyfriend who plays mm-hmm. for the cricket team. And they're there with right. the whole cricket team. So that's.
Right. He's like the captain of Oxford's cricket team, I think it was. And Belinda sends George a letter saying, oh, well, we can see each other platonically.
Right.
And they go out and they do some stuff platonic, but.
He's still trying to.
George, of course, yeah. He's still trying to kind of get in there.
Yeah. I mean, there's that whole bit with the hotel key, which was.
Yeah, he says at one point, like, they're staying in. They take it like a day trip somewhere. Well, not really a day trip because they're staying overnight, but they take a trip somewhere to. Brighton, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then he says, they're staying in separate hotel rooms. And he says, yeah, but I stole a spare key to her room from the front desk.
Yeah. At this point, I was like, oh, this is
like 1965. It's a whole different world, man. Like, you could not do that today.
I was like, dude, that's creep mode. I would.
You could not physically do that, and you could not, you should not morally do that.
As that scene was hoping, I was like, oh no, where is this going? Oh no, am I about to? Because like he even says like, oh yeah, I would walk in, hopefully she'd be undressed. And I was like, oh no, oh no.
Yeah, and it's like, are you just going to crawl into bed with her?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, where is the story going? Oh no.
I mean,
oh,
you
no.
get a feeling that that's kind of what he's hoping. And I guess that was considered okay and romantic in 1965, maybe. I don't know. It might have been sketchy then. I don't know. I wasn't alive yet.
Dude, I'm so uncomfortable with this conversation. I'm sweating.
There's like a little bit of, I guess you could say karma, because he ends up having stomach issues and he's trying to sneak over to Belinda's room. And he's like, and yeah, I had to go back into my room because I had the worst diarrhea of my life.
Finally, diarrhea steps in. Saves the day.
Diarrhea saves the day. He was like, you know, I'd deal with that, and then I'd get all cleaned up, and then I'd try to go back, and then I'd have another bout of that, and apparently he's just going back and forth to his toilet the entire night.
Thank you, diarrhea. Thank you.
And the next morning, like, Belinda's like, hey, I'm really surprised you didn't try to sneak over last night.
You really have changed.
So... I don't know what the lesson to take away from this is. Like, diarrhea does good things sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't
know. No one talks about the positive of diarrhea.
I don't know.
Diarrhea is out here saving lives.
But it's one of those stories you're like, really?
Yeah. Really? I guess.
That happened like that? That's...
Yeah. I think that's the point where the director was like, did this all really happen?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. How could I remember if it didn't happen?
Right.
Or, yeah, my Australian's kind of waning.
Yeah. So Belinda moves in with him. You know, he's continuing on. He's gotten a job as a car salesman in England. He's doing well at that. And a customer comes in one day, and the customer says to George Lazenby, I want to take pictures of you. You're a handsome fellow. I think you could make it as a male model.
Yeah, and of course. Yeah, he immediately is like, oh, this guy's trying to...
he's trying to hit on me.
Yeah, exactly.
He's one of those poofdas, as they would say in Australia. I don't know if that's an acceptable term or not.
I
don't know.
All our Australian listeners, please let us know. Let us know.
I hope I didn't just slur.
Just let us know.
Yeah. It sounds so benign. I don't know.
It sounds benign to us, but like, I'm sure if you go to another country, they'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah, okay. But foreign slang always sounds more fun and goofy than actual hurtful.
That's not our word to say.
Yeah, but the guy says to George, he's like, hey, rugged guys are in right now. And so, yeah, George, he ends up getting headshots, and he takes him to a modeling agency, and he says, I became one of Europe's top models overnight, and I was working 7 days a week. So he has to quit his car salesman job because he's doing so well as a male model.
That is crazy. Just like at the snap of a finger, he just becomes like one of the top models. Like, that's like one of those things you hear about.
Yeah.
But you never hear it happens where like you're just walking down the street and somebody's like, you there, you got what it takes to be a model. And then you just become a huge, like the only person I've heard that actually happen is I think I heard that like Sofia Vergara started. That's how that happened with her. Like, she was like literally like a teenager walking down the street and somebody approached her about being a model. And
wow.
She became a model. She became like a big time model in Colombia.
I mean, that's supposed to be like the classic Hollywood story. Like, I think that happened to like Betty Grable or somebody like that, where it's just they're spotted on the street and it's like, hey, you got it, kid. I'm going to make you a star. And
I like the cut of your jib.
Yeah. And so, so he becomes this big male model, and he just kind of falls back asswards into it.
Yeah. That's pretty much his life. Yeah.
It really is. He is just like falling upward for the first 30 years of his life. It's kind of amazing.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And he becomes a spokesman for Big Fry's Chocolate, where he's like this big, he's playing this big burly guy who's like hauling this big carton of the Big Fry's Chocolate around.
Right.
And so I think he was well known in England from those commercials. Yeah. Or at least known by sight.
Right.
And that's acting of a sort, I would say, even if he didn't have dialogue. I would say that's acting.
Yeah, you could say it. Like, you know, it's like mime work or whatever. But yeah. There's some acting involved in there.
So his modeling career is continuing. He says, like, I took a job in Spain with three girls. I have in my notes, German model suggestively eats banana.
Yes, of course. Nothing subtle about that at all.
We just see her at the craft services table next to George, and she's just like, shoving that whole banana into her mouth. And
I think George, would you give me that banana, please?
And then just... and she's like, no, the bigger one. And then just like,
Ach du lieber.
And then George is at the airport, and the German model comes and invites him to Majorca. And he's like, I can't go with you. I've already put my bag on the plane back to London. And she's like, no, come with me to Majorca. So he calls his girlfriend Belinda and says, oh, my job's been extended for a week. I'll see you in 7 days. And he just fucks off to Majorca to go.
Wow. Yeah.
Shag a German model.
Wow. Yeah. I
okay, George.
I mean, it sucks because like we spent all this time of him like, you know, chasing after Belinda, this unrequited love, and then he finally gets it, and then later on he's some German model shakes her tush and he's like, "All right, well, goodbye." And he just goes after. It's like, but then again, he was like super young, and young people do dumb shit.
Young people do stupid things, and it was the 60s, and you know, that was much more common, I would say. And then, like, as soon as he gets back home, he says, like, Belinda knew that I cheated on her, and that was it. So, yeah, he fucked that one up. And
he certainly did.
You get the feeling from the regret that he talks about this with that he would not do the same thing again.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up, but it's just, I'll just chalk it up to just being young and dumb and just doing dumb shit, and it's just well, it's unfortunate.
Yeah. So okay. So then the movie like cuts to 1968. It's like 3 years later. He's living with another male model, Ken Garrity, who is like another Australian male model. And he talks about how they would pick up women together and they would have threesomes.
Yeah.
And Ken, at one point, he like puts acid in George's tea when they're entertaining another woman together.
Yeah. Like he just puts, they meet some girl off the street and they invite her up to their place. And Ken is like, "Oh yeah, put acid in all our teas."
Like don't leave the apartment for a while because you are about to start hallucinating. And
I was like, "Wow, what is?"
I know this happened to like the Beatles too. They were at some dinner party, and their host was like, "Oh yeah, I put LSD in your tea."
I was. Like,
I guess that was just a thing you did in the 60s.
Yeah, but I still, it's like you're drugging people, man.
I know you're drugging people without their knowledge and.
Ay, ay, ay. What is
He has this trip, and then, you know, he and the woman wake up the next morning, and then he says, "Yeah, and we walked to the bus stop, and we thought we'd gotten dressed, but we just took a pile of our clothes and had them under our arm. We were both walking to the bus stop naked."
Holding your clothes. Holding
their clothes.
Not wearing. Holding.
Not wearing. Holding, just carrying your clothes. Yeah. That's like wearing clothes, right?
Kinda. They're there. So, you know.
Yeah. So about this time, he meets this woman, an agent by the name of Maggie Abbott. And Maggie Abbott, played by Jane Seymour.
I did not see that coming.
Which is really amazing because Jane Seymour was a Bond girl. Jane Seymour is the leading lady in Roger Moore's first Bond movie, Live and Let Die.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, she plays Solitaire, who was like the fortune teller.
Solitaire? That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she had like tarot cards and she was like telling people's fortunes through the tarot cards.
Oh, clever. Yeah, I mean, like, usually Bond girls are named like something sexually suggestive. That's why like Solitaire, I was like, oh, that's not what I expected. I expected like, you know, bushy sex legs or something.
Yes.
But
yes.
You know,
bushy
Solitaire.
Sex legs.
I don't know, man. Hey, I'm just like, thinking off.
They're named like, you know, like Holly Goodhead or Pussy Galore or
exactly.
Rebecca Exceptional Fellatio.
That's, I think you made that last one up.
No. She's a real Bond girl. She's a real Bond girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll take
trust
your word
me
for it.
She starts, like, he meets Maggie when his friend and roommate Ken, he's like, "Hey, I'm double booked. I've got a date with another bird, and I've got a, can you take her to this premiere?" And so he strikes up this friendship, I guess, relationship with Maggie. He doesn't really say if they were romantic or not, but.
Yeah, they don't, they're kind of vague on it, but like, I think, like he took her to this concert and like, the Beatles were there in the concert, and like she knows the Beatles,
Stones,
and she knows the Rolling Stones. So he felt like, "Oh,
well,
I'm in high society.
I'm in the big time now." Yeah,
I'm in the big time.
And he says, like, "I went back to Paris," because he's like living in Paris at this point. This is the first we hear that he's now living in Paris.
Yeah, that came out of nowhere too. I was like, "Whoa, what happened to?"
I'm like, "All right. When did you move to Paris? Maybe tell us that you moved to Paris at some point." But I guess this is how we find out. And then Maggie calls him about a film she wants him to try out for her, and she's like, I don't want to say what it is over the phone.
Right.
And we are now like 50 minutes into this picture, and we are just now getting to how he got cast as James
again, Bond. Something else I wrote down. I was like, we're just now talking about the movie's literally halfway over.
Yeah.
Probably more than half, actually.
The movie's like an hour and a half, and we do not get to James Bond until like literally 50 minutes in.
Okay.
I mean, it's fascinating stories throughout.
Yeah.
I mean, the man lived a life.
He did. But I was like, I mean, the Bond thing, that's like kind of the meat and potatoes of this whole film.
Yeah, I mean, that's why people are plunking down and plunking down their money to check this out. But yeah, so yeah, Maggie says, I think you're right for James Bond. So he talks about how he meets Dyson Lovell, who's the casting director.
Right.
But he's not in the union, so he like has to sneak into the audition. He has to sneak past the receptionist.
Right, right. And he also mentions how he knew where Sean Connery got his suits tailored and his haircut.
Mm-hmm.
So he figured he'd get his haircut just like Connery, and then he went to the tailor where Connery got his suits, and like I guess he couldn't afford a suit like Connery, but he found out there was a suit that Connery had made for him, but Connery never picked it up. So
right.
He just like swiped it and bounced.
Yeah, I'd always heard that story as he got a suit from the tailor and it was something that Connery never picked up. This movie was the first place I'd ever heard, oh no, I stole that suit. And I'm wondering if that might be an exaggeration that came in over time. But
yeah.
And he was like, oh, and I already had a Rolex. He like runs past the receptionist there when she like is ducking down to grab something from the floor or something.
Doing something
like
else. Yeah, and the receptionist was like, hey, you can't go in there.
Right. And he like runs upstairs to Harry Saltzman, who is one of the Bond producers. And Harry Saltzman is played by Jeff Garvin from Curb Your Enthusiasm. And
The
Goldbergs.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff Garlin just popping out of nowhere. Just him and his big boisterous self.
Yeah. And he plays him as a big guy. I mean, the way the Bond movies works were they were formed with the partnership with Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. And they both, I think, wanted to produce the Bond movies, and they eventually decided, hey, well, let's just form a partnership and then we'll produce them together. And they did that, and they would like alternate on the Bond movies as to like which one would be the primary producer.
Right.
On each one. So like, you know, Cubby would do one, then Harry would do one. And so like by the time Honor Majesty's Secret Service came around, it was Harry was kind of taking the point.
Right, right, right.
So yeah. And like Lazenby, he gets £500 to come back for a callback, and he tells Maggie about this, and she's like, I've never heard of that happening.
Yeah.
Like, what?
It's this thing with George where he's just has this confidence about him that, like, people automatically, like, react to or, you know, react positively to, where he's just able to get all of these things. Just like he said, like, he didn't even graduate high school, but he just has, like, the will and the confidence and the swagger to pull off getting all of these things for him. Like,
I mean, it really is a testament to how far confidence can take you if you're a white man, I suppose.
Yes. That's the limit.
Let's be real here. But like, I mean, if you're a confidence and you're self-assured and you're like, yes, I belong here. And because like Harry Saltzman at one point, he's like, well, hey, what have you done? And he's like, hey, I just told your man here all my credits.
Let him tell you.
And he said that because he didn't want to get caught in a lie and tell Harry Saltzman something different that he told the casting director.
Right. Absolutely.
Which, I mean, that's amazing. And then when he finally meets the director of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Peter Hunt, who like comes in from like a scouting trip in Switzerland. And he finally comes clean to Peter Hunt. And he's like, I've never acted a day in my life.
And Peter Hunt was like, thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. And he says, you fooled two of the most ruthless men I know. Stick with me. I will make you James Bond.
Jesus.
And they just kind of agree to have a partnership at this point. And Peter Hunt, by the way, he was the editor on all the early Bond films. And this was his first shot as the director of the Bond film. Now you haven't seen Honor Majesty's Secret Service, right?
No. I watched it a little bit before recording this, so that's what the highlights.
Okay, how far did you get in, or did you just watch it like a compilation or something?
Yeah, a compilation. I caught the cliff notes.
I'm going to keep talking about Honor Majesty's Secret Service like spoiler free for your benefit and for the benefit of anybody who hasn't seen the film.
Okay.
I do recommend the film. I think it's very good. It's one of my favorite Bond films.
Ooh.
I would put it like in my top three, along with Goldfinger and Casino Royale.
Top three? Wow.
Top three. It's good.
All right.
It's good stuff, man.
Okay.
So Peter Hunt was kind of was getting his first shot to do the Bond films, and he was directing for the first time. And we've got a new untested actor. And he's also kind of bringing the Bond series back down to earth.
Right.
Because like the Bond films, they would get bigger and bigger with each entry. And in You Only Live Twice, like it was literally, the plot was literally, there was like a satellite that was gobbling up Russian and US satellites. And Bond had to stop that. And that's the one with the hollowed out volcano headquarters.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, so it got really big in the scale, and Peter Hunt was like, let's bring it all back down to earth and get closer to the original Ian Fleming novels. And at the very beginning of the movie, like we see Q in M's office, and he's like, oh, we've just perfected this new device of radioactive lint, and it's going to help us track our agents and stuff. And it's like, it's basically saying like the gadgets and things have gotten too absurd. We're going to bring this back down to earth.
Radioactive lint, you say?
Radioactive lint. It sounds very
all right.
Whimsical. Yeah. Yeah. And M's just like, ah, that's a dumb idea. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's a sequence in Honor Majesty's Secret Service where Bond has to escape, and he doesn't have any gizmos on him. And he's at this Swiss ski chalet.
Mm-hmm.
And he like rips the insides of his pockets out of his pants, and he uses those to like kind of shimmy along the cable for the cable car. And
cool.
You know, it's very cool because you're seeing him like rely more on his wits than just whatever gizmo he got.
Okay.
So yeah, so he does a screen test. They have him like riding horses and swims, neither of which he does in the film. So I'm like, why are you having him ride horses and swim? But
yeah, very true.
Okay. It's very weird. And then he also tells a story about how the producers like sent a woman to his room to, I guess, test if he's gay or not.
Yeah, that was... I was like, that can't, is that, could that be true?
I'm just like, I hope this isn't real, because if this is real, this is really fucked up in every direction. And he's like, oh yeah, this guy came and he had a woman with him. And the guy is played by Jake Johnson, Nick from New Girl.
Yeah. Peter B. Parker.
Yeah. And it's just like, oh, random Jake Johnson cameo. I'd kind of forgotten that was here. And George like gets together with this woman while this guy is in the room, and he's just kind of observing.
He's like eating an apple, reading a newspaper.
Yeah, and George is like, "Are we gonna have a go together?" And the guy's like, "No, I'm just gonna be here." And then he just like, I guess, reports back to the producers. He's like, "Yeah, the guy's straight.
Thumbs
he
up.
Can be your new James Bond."
The '60s were the wildest of times.
They were wild. I mean, I guess they thought he was gay because he was a male model.
Yeah, that's what they said. It's like, oh, he's a male model. He must be.
Yeah.
Wow. What a time. What a time to be alive.
The '60s were a different time. So they find out he's not gay. They put their fears to rest. He has a series of screen tests that last for 4 months.
Yeah.
And he, at the final stunt test, he doesn't pull his punch and he breaks a stuntman's nose. I've heard that story.
Oh, really?
So apparently that story is real.
Wow.
Or at the very least, he's been telling it for a very, very long time.
Okay.
And
yeah, because I think they said, oh, yeah, he's from Australia. He must know how to fight.
Yeah.
Which.
And he accidentally punches this guy for real and breaks his nose. And then Harry Saltzman comes up and he's like, we're going with you.
Yeah.
That
is crazy.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
This complete unknown has replaced one of the biggest movie stars in the world in his iconic role.
That is bonkers.
It's such a wild story.
Right. And we'll probably touch on it towards the end of this, but yeah, at this point he hadn't even signed a contract yet.
Like he just, no.
Which is
weird.
Yeah,
he somehow does the entire film and he gets away with not signing his contract.
Which is
the entire time he's shooting the film.
Yeah, he mentions that at the end. I was like, you can't do that. They just needed to get this movie out like ASAP. That just somebody just like, contract. We'll figure it out.
I mean, something that big would probably be booked in theaters before or while you were shooting it, but.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you get away with that. I don't know how you do that. I don't know. It's weird. But like George talks about how he's sent to the south of France to kind of avoid all the press because they're doing the big Life magazine story.
Right. They don't want it to get out.
Right. They don't want it to get out. But he calls up Belinda and invites her and tells her, and then he's called back to London for a press conference.
Right.
Announcing that he's going to be the new James Bond.
Right. And it happened last minute. So the minute Belinda touches down in France, he's like, hey, Belinda, I got to go to London, but I'll be right back.
Yeah. I'll be back in like a day or two. And then that's when he says, I didn't see her again for another 20 years.
Yeah.
And by that point, she was married with kids.
Yeah.
Like and we see President Day George Lazenby, and he gets genuinely choked up. This is probably the big regret in his life. I mean, that was the one that got away for him.
Yeah, no, you definitely feel like wow, I botched that beyond belief, and
yeah,
like, I'm really sorry I did that.
Wife and mother of his children, only mentioned in passing.
Yeah,
just saying. If I was George Lazenby's wife, I might be like, what the fuck's going on here, George?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Then after this movie, I married this woman and had these kids, and the end.
Yeah, but you don't want to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk in great detail and length about the one that got away.
So he goes to Switzerland to shoot the movie because, you know, much of the movie takes place in Switzerland at Blofeld's headquarters, the big villain.
Right, right.
And it's Telly Savalas playing Blofeld, the pre-Kojak Telly Savalas.
Who loves you, baby?
And Diana Rigg, who then was best known for the Avengers, now is probably maybe more known for Game of Thrones.
Oh, right. She's in that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But she was Emma Peel. And I think part of the reason they cast those was to kind of make up for George's inexperience.
Yeah, that makes sense. You want
more. So they went with bigger stars.
Yeah, just sort of pad the movie a bit with some
right. Right.
People and that have done it before.
Make up for his shortcomings. And George talks about how he realized that, you know, people wanted to see like the Sean Connery version of James Bond.
Right. Exactly.
And they're giving him like voice lessons so he can speak like an Englishman and you know, like putting a match in his mouth and, you know,
right.
working the right muscles in his face and
right, having him enunciate.
Yeah. And he talks about shooting the gun barrel sequence and he just to be defiant, I guess, he drops down to one knee when he's shooting the gun, which is
right.
just different from how Connery did it. And they're like, no, do exactly what Connery did. And he's like, no, I don't want to.
Right. But I mean, I sort of get that, like, with the mm-hmm. studio, because, like, there are so many people who are just purist about things like that. You know, like we have people who are purist about how a Marvel movie should look, or purist who about how, I don't know, like a Harry Potter story should be. So I can understand there would be like purist with people who think about how James Bond should be. Like I can't see like him like dropping his knee like that, and then like, you know, the James Bond fandom people would be like, this, that's not how James Bond does it. He's doing it wrong and whatnot.
Right. And I mean, this was the first time they recast that role. So there wasn't really a precedent for this. I mean, for other characters, sure. Like, I think Cubby Broccoli very famously said when Sean Connery quit the role, he said, there were 14 Tarzans.
Wow.
And so he was basically saying, we can easily replace you.
Okay.
But Sean Connery was so identified with the role. And yeah, so everyone was like, yo, you've got to do it like Sean did it.
Right.
And I rewatched the movie yesterday, and you can kind of see in the movie that there are places where they're kind of scared. Like,
what do you mean? Like,
there are bits like early on in the film where there are like obviously dubbed lines in there where it's giving like Bond more funny lines.
Mm.
And a few, like, you can tell that George Lazenby's lips aren't even moving in there. They're just like, oh, he's not as funny as Sean was. We got to give him a little more.
Got to pump. Yeah.
We got to give him a little more sarcasm. We got to
put some funny in this.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually there's a long sequence in the movie where Bond goes undercover as this other character, Sir Hilary Bray. And they actually have that actor dub George Lazenby during that. So like there's a good 20, 30 minutes of the movie or something where we are not hearing George Lazenby's voice.
Huh.
Which is just bizarre. And you're just like, you never would have done that to Sean Connery.
Yeah. I don't agree with it, but I do get it. Cause you know, it's a thing where people are just afraid to mess with the formula that works. So they don't want to,
they didn't want to rock the boat.
Yeah. Stick with the tried and true.
Yeah. So Lazenby, he goes through the entire shoot without signing his contract somehow.
Again, look, I'm no fancy Hollywood agent, but I feel like if you're going to do a movie, you got to sign some type of contract.
Yeah.
You got to sign something. I don't know.
And it's bizarre. And they're trying to like kind of seal the deal before the release of the movie. And George says, like, I was offered a slave contract to do like 6 more Bond movies.
Right.
And wanted to tie him up for a long time.
Right. And basically, I think they said like a slave contract was kind of limits what you can and cannot do, because like, you know, they don't want the actor, even when he's not on film, to be doing things that wouldn't be indicative of James Bond. Like, oh, James Bond does this. He doesn't do this. They make a point to mention that the fact that George grew out a beard really bothered the studio, because like James Bond didn't have a beard. He's clean shaven.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even today, the Bond actors, from what I understand, I know this was the case with Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig. They were like, they're forbidden from wearing a tuxedo in other films.
Really?
While they're playing James Bond. Yeah.
Wow. That is.
That's like James Bond's thing.
Oh, so, wow. That's a little overkill, but I guess
they don't want them to be, you know, playing on the Bond image too much and doing that. I mean, you see all the Bond actors, they all do it to some degree after they leave the part, but I guess they don't want them to be doing it while they're in the part. Like, they don't want to be like Roger Moore doing Cannonball Run or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, that's... So, wow, so you can't even wear a tuxedo in another movie? That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and he got into hot water because he grew his beard out and he grew his hair long.
Yeah.
Because 1969, and he refused to shave it off for the premiere. And so he shows up at the premiere with like long hair and a beard, and he looks very un-James Bondish.
Yeah, no, the studio was heated about that.
Yeah,
I understand, because again, they don't want to mess with the formula. Like, James Bond is this; he's not that.
And at this point, we are seeing some clips of the real George Lazenby interspersed in there, like actual press conferences from the time, some appearances that he's done at the time. We see him with what's his name, Frost, the British.
Oh, Frost Nixon?
Yeah, the Frost Nixon guy. David Frost.
David Frost, yes.
Yeah, we see him on the David Frost show. But I guess they couldn't get rights to footage from the Tonight Show, because when we get to his appearance on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, Johnny Carson is played by Dana Carvey.
And that's the SNL connection.
That is the SNL connection.
An hour and 25 minutes into the movie.
Yeah. And George announces on the Tonight Show that, yeah, he's a one and done. He doesn't want to do James Bond anymore.
Yeah, it's, again, that's like another thing that's like still crazy. Like, they're offering him all this money, a man who had no acting experience at all, who just kind of BS'd his way into it. And like, he's just walking away from all this. I mean, I think even in the movie, he couldn't really explain why he walked away. He was just like, my heart wasn't in it. I just didn't want to be an actor anymore, really.
Well, I mean, he said in other interviews and things like that, he was like, I felt it was Connery's gig and not mine. I wanted to be my own man. And he also was getting this advice that, yeah, like the James Bond thing is going to be over. Because, I mean, it had been going on for like 7 years at that point.
Right.
So, you would naturally think, oh, yeah, this bubble is about to burst. I mean, who knew that it would go on for another 50-odd years?
That makes sense, yeah. You don't think it would be like the Fast and the Furious of its day or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you look at this now and it's like that guy who told the Beatles, oh yeah, guitar groups are on the way out. You know, you look at that with 2020 hindsight and you're like, oh, that was so laughably wrong. But
yeah, you don't even know that guy's name. It's just some guy.
Yeah, and so he's, you know, so George Lazenby is kind of the Pete Best of the Bond movies, because he just did the one and then he left the part.
Right. Yeah. Because like, I think when you think of James Bond, I mean, you think of like the standouts, like, you know, Connery's and Timothy Dalton's and whatnot. But yeah, George Lazenby is the one that always kind of goes by the wayside.
And he is very much the odd man out in the Bond franchise, because because he only did one, and both because Honor Majesty's Secret Service broke away from the Bond formula quite a bit.
Yes, absolutely.
Up until that point. It does some things. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. It doesn't do things in the way that a typical Bond film did up until that point.
Shakes things up.
And apparently there are also rumors that, yeah, he kind of got a big head and he started acting like a star before he actually was one.
Yeah, I think he does admit that in the movie. It was like, you know, like when he was Bond, he was, you know, just constant women, constant drugs, constant drinking. And just, I mean, but I get it. Like, when you have people taking pictures of you and all these women saying, oh, he's so handsome. Like, how can you not get a big head? How can you not be like, oh, wow, I guess I'm the next big thing?
It's kind of like that Bill Murray quote about being famous. It's like, when you get famous, everybody has a year or two where you act like an asshole. It's just inevitable. But you have to shake it off within that time, or else it becomes permanent.
Oh, wow. I don't think I ever knew that Bill Murray
quote. Yeah, that's a great Bill Murray quote. I always
pretty solid.
That. And, you know, you can debate as to how much Bill Murray shook that off. I mean, I don't know.
That's for another podcast for another time.
Yeah, I mean, but yeah, George, he's even told stories that he was like, oh yeah, I had a thing, like, you know, Diana Rigg and I were going to hook up, but she said, oh, you can't mess around with any other women, and he messed around with other women, and that was
you don't
was
say.
Yeah, I mean, I can believe him messing around with other women, and you know, especially when they're in Switzerland at some remote location and there's nothing to do.
Yeah,
that's kind of a recipe for hooking up with the people you're stuck there with. Yeah, and it's him and like a dozen beautiful women.
Yeah, they're just everywhere. It's like, yeah, it's hey man.
Yeah. He had his fun, and apparently he had a falling out with the director Peter Hunt during the movie.
Oh, too. Did they mention that? I don't think they mentioned.
They didn't mention that in this. This is something I just know from reading more about the Bond films stuff. But yeah, he inadvertently pissed off Peter Hunt when I think there was some party and he told like some of Peter Hunt's friends to go away or something like that, and that pissed off Peter Hunt. And I think he also, I remember somebody else involved with the film saying like, "Oh, I didn't get a personal invitation to this rap party." And they're like, "Well, no, George, it was on the call sheet. Everybody was invited." And he's like, "Yeah, but I'm the star of the picture."
Oh, boy.
They were like, and then I think it was when one of the producers, Cubby Broccoli or Harry Saltzman, said, "No, you're not a star because you say so. You're a star when the public says so." So,
that's fair point. Fair point.
Yeah, they were trying to get his head screwed on straight. But okay, we kind of glossed over Dana Carvey playing Johnny Carson. What did you think of the Dana Carvey cameo? Was it good or was it distracting? How did you react to it?
A little distracting. I thought he'd look more like Johnny Carson did in his heyday. They didn't make him up to look quite like Johnny Carson. He just kind of looked like Dana Carvey in like a suit,
yeah,
and brownish hair. I like, when I saw him, I was like, oh, that's Dana. Like, he didn't turn into Johnny Carson. I was like, oh, that's just Dana Carvey in a 60s suit. So
I kind of kept expecting him to go, you know, weird, wild stuff and do his whole Dana Carveyisms as Carson. Maybe they couldn't match the footage too closely, legally.
That makes sense. I didn't even think of that. Yeah.
Maybe I know like some old Tonight shows were wiped or recorded over. So maybe that footage doesn't exist anymore. I don't know.
I'll look on YouTube. Maybe I can find this clip there. But yeah, I thought
it'd be interesting to see the real clips. But
yeah, I thought Carvey did an okay job. He does. The Johnny Carson impression is like one of his go to. He did it forever during his run in the 80s. So like it's something he just can like slip right back into, like, you know, like an old pair of slippers.
It was always a great Carson impression, but it does get a little distracting to see it in the context of a recreation or something. You're just
a little bit,
because your brain is just going, that is not Johnny Carson, that is Dana Carvey doing Johnny Carson.
Yes, very much so.
And I've seen him do that in many a comedy skit. So
weird, wild stuff.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Yes. I saw the Carsenio Hall sketch. I saw that.
Yeah, it was so weird to me when I was first watching this, because like it was just like, ah, sudden unexpected Dana Carvey.
Carvey.
Yeah, and it's just, because there have been so many SNL cast members, it's just, you see them pop up in the most unexpected places.
Yeah, absolutely, very much so.
So the film kind of glosses over his life after he leaves the Bond role. It doesn't really get into that. Yeah,
they do talk about how he kind of got blacklisted after, because, you know, I guess he made it official on the Carson show that he wasn't coming back, which...
Right.
That can't make the studio happy. So, like, he kind of...
Well, you know, it also just makes it really, really tough to promote the film, because you have this brand new actor
there,
and you know he's not going to go on. So you're not going to throw a lot of money into George Lazenby as the new James Bond.
Right.
So they kind of just concentrated on Bond the character. There's actually, like, an ad where, like, it's Bond, and he's like holding up the gun, the Walther PPK, but his face is in shadow.
Ooh,
because they're just promoting it as, you know, James Bond is back. Because good does it do him to promote an actor who's leaving the role after this movie?
It's like that whole James Gunn thing with the DC when he announced all the other movies that are coming out. So all these movies coming out this year kind of don't mean anything.
Yeah, he was kind of like a lame duck James Bond.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But they don't mention much about what after that. Like, I guess he got blacklisted. It doesn't seem like he appeared in any movies after this at all.
No, he did do movies after.
He
continued working as an actor. He did like spaghetti westerns in Italy. He was supposed to do a movie with like Bruce Lee, but then Bruce Lee passed away.
Wow.
This was like early 70s. He of course never really reached those heights again.
Right.
He was never a star in a picture, but he did a few odd roles here and there that kind of played off the James Bond image.
Mm-hmm.
There was a reunion movie in the early 80s. I posted this on the SNL Nerds Twitter account on Sunday. And George Lazenby has a cameo as, like, quote unquote, JB, who's like driving an Aston Martin around, and he helps out Napoleon Solo in this Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie.
And
they, you know, they kind of like, you know, do the knowing nod to each other. And the woman even says, like, oh, it's just like on Her Majesty's Secret Service, you know, and he's like in a tux and the whole thing. And it's, and he did another episode of like the 1980s Alfred Hitchcock Presents where he's playing like a James Bond type role.
Wow. And, okay.
Yeah. And they literally, he says, like, my name's Honk, James Honk, like background noise is, I've seen clips of it. It's kind of funny.
All right. That's pretty clever. At least he's had fun with it. All right.
He has fun with it. And he was on the Superboy syndicated TV show from the late 80s. He played Jor-El.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. They made him up just like the Marlon Brando Jor-El with a white wig and all that. He's on, he did a voice in the Batman Beyond cartoon.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
And he even at one point in that cartoon says, "We have all the time in the world," which is kind of a refrain in the On Her Majesty's Secret Service movie. So that was a cute little in joke.
Very cute. Very clever.
So, you know, he's done stuff. And mm-hmm. I actually met George Lazenby a couple times at conventions.
Oh, no way.
I haven't told you this story, I don't think.
I don't think so.
The first one, this is a local convention here in New Jersey. It was not far from my place. And I went to see him, and I wanted to get my DVD copy of On Her Majesty's Secret Service autographed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was charging like way more for his autograph than I was expecting. And it was not only more money than I had on me at the time.
Right.
But more money than I think I paid for the DVD. He was charging, I think, like $35, $40 for his autograph.
That seems... I mean, I'm not in the autograph game. Is that a lot?
It's a lot. Okay. It's a lot.
All right. I
mean, if you want the autograph, I mean, if the people are willing to pay it, you go, George.
Right.
You get that money. I don't begrudge anyone making a living, but it was literally more money than I had on me, and I could not pay it. And so then I had to sort of awkwardly be like, oh, I'm going to go borrow money from my friend who's over there. And I walked off, and I did not come back to George Lazenby's table. And I just have images of, like, George Lazenby couldn't buy dinner that night because of me. And I felt bad about it. But then a few years later, He did that convention or another local convention again.
Same price?
And this time I went, I did have enough money to pay for the autograph, whatever it was. And so I got him to sign my DVD of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. So I feel like I redeemed myself. I made it good.
Nice. Okay. All right. You made it right.
And there was a moment there where I said, you know, your Bond movie, it's one of my favorites. It's one of my absolute favorites. I really like the movie, and I like you in the movie. And he just said, well, I did my best. And he just said it. It was just a little wistful, the way he said it.
Oh, really?
Like it was still kind of a regret in his life. But, and like towards the end of this movie, he was just like, yeah, I should have done too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, because, like, I mean, in the movie after this, he, like you said, he did some other acting work, and then it seems like he got out of the business altogether and, like, just went into, like, real estate and, like, motocross at some point.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about that. I don't think he was really making his main living as an actor, but I think he would take the acting gigs where he could.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think he did make most of his money in real estate. And I think he did well in real estate and did okay for himself. But
yeah, he did fine. He did all right. But, yeah, it is... interesting about that.
And he got married and he had some kids.
Yeah.
And doesn't really get into that. They just show a few pictures of him with his wife and his daughters, I think it was.
I think so, yeah.
Sons. It shows you how little they feature them that I don't even remember the genders of his kids.
Yeah, they flashed him by in a second.
You're like, you never even hear his wife's name. It's just
person. Right. Just
you'll find out all about Belinda. God yes. damn it.
All about Belinda.
But he says towards the end, he says, you can defy what is expected of you and write your own story.
That's fair enough.
I think that's a great quote. And, you know, I don't know if it was so much like he left the role by choice as he presents it, but.
I guess
it was his choice, but yeah.
I guess like that's the one thing. It does kind of get a little hazy around mm-hmm. that time, because it does seem like. Well, I mean, he said like he didn't want to do it anymore. And because he grew out the beard, it seemed like he grew out the beard sort of in defiance of the studio, because like it seemed like the studio wanted to sign his contract.
Well, he says in the documentary, he says like, oh, I grew the beard because I didn't want to be recognized. But then if you don't want to be recognized, why wouldn't you shave off the beard for the premiere?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because you know, then you could go back to having the beard be your go-to disguise. So it really does seem like more of an act of defiance.
Yeah, absolutely. Because even in the movie, they say in the beginning, like, as a kid, he was a bit of a maverick. He likes to, mm-hmm. you know, cause trouble, and he really didn't like to being told what to do. So, like, it's something like this, where the studio's telling him to sign this contract, we'll give you this money, and it'd be like a slave contract, like you said. That seemed, like, automatically.
And they want to give him another million under the table, he said.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, the fact that he knows, oh, I gotta sign this, and I'll be restricted what I cannot do. So fuck that. Like I think his immediate reaction would be just like to thumb his nose at the powers that be.
Yeah, and they actually show an interview clip of him from at the time when he's promoting the film. They were like, if you had to choose, would you be Bond again or would you go back to being a car salesman? And he says, I would go back to being a car salesman.
Yeah, see, and the studio probably saw that and were like, well, fuck this guy. We ain't giving him any money.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think, you know, when somebody gets labeled as a troublemaker or ungrateful or whatever, yeah, people don't want to work with you.
Yeah, like I think that happened with, Knocked Up. I forget her name.
Catherine Heigl?
Catherine Heigl, yeah, she got kind of that labeled hit on
yeah,
her.
Yeah, she kind of criticized the film a few years later.
Yeah, like, you know, like Jared Leto gets kind of labeled that too, where he's like difficult to work with and whatnot. It happens. Even like they had a clip of Diana Riggs kind of bad mouthing him a little bit in an interview. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she was like, oh yeah, he kind of made his own bed.
Yeah. I was like, damn.
And yeah, to a degree, I see that. And yeah, he probably didn't behave as well as he could have or should have.
Right. But then again, like I said, it's a thing where when you're this big hot new star and everybody tells you you're awesome and everybody mm-hmm. wants to sleep with you and give you whatever. Like, how can you not get a big
head? How does that not go to your head at least a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. You got to be like, well, yeah, I guess I'm the next big thing. I'm hot shit.
And it's so funny that supreme confidence he had both got him the role and lost him the role.
Yes, exactly. Wow.
Because he was just so self-assured.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he thought at the time, well, hey, I'm a star now. I'm going to go on and do my own thing and make my own movies and be a star in my own right. And I'll be as big as Sean Connery.
Yeah. And then the studio was like, nope.
And no, you won't either, because we are not going to give you any opportunities to on the scale of James Bond.
Yeah. Flew too close to the sun.
It really is. Yeah. It's like his pride was, you know, both got him to where he was, but it was also his downfall too.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating, actually.
But if he didn't want that, I guess he's better off.
I guess, yeah. I mean, sometimes people don't want fame and tons of money. They just want to, you know, their own little thing and enough money to survive and live and do their own thing. Fame's not for everybody. I don't know.
Yeah, he didn't seem like he was an unhappy guy. He just seemed like this nice old bloke who tells lots of fun stories about his wild and crazy youth.
Yeah, pretty much. He was like a bloke you see down at the pub.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, he is a good storyteller.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's like, I don't know how much of this is bullshit, but I'm enjoying hearing it.
Yeah, that's just, like, I kind of went into this whole thing listening into it. It's like, all right, this is entertaining. I'm not going to take it all as fact, but from what I'm hearing, I do enjoy it.
What did you think of the reenactments, the stuff? Did those work for you?
I think so. Yeah, I think some of them were pretty good. Yeah. Some of them were a little, like I said, with Dana Carvey, was like, oh, I don't know about this. But like, for the most part, that was an interesting way to present and tell the story?
I mean, the guy playing young George Lazenby, he doesn't look too much like him.
No, not at all.
He's certainly not as handsome as he was. I mean, they gave him the same cleft chin. That was about it.
The cleft did all the work, all the heavy lifting.
And it is funny, like in Drunk History, when we see them like mouthing the words that the real George Lazenby is saying.
Yes, but... absolutely. Yeah, sometimes they like break the fourth wall where that he's talking to the camera and somebody like says, "Who are you talking to?" type of thing.
Yeah, and it is funny to see like known actors like Jane Seymour and Jeff Garlin just pop up.
Yeah.
Like, oh, weird. That's funky.
Yeah, well, it takes you out of it a little bit, but
no. It does. But
the Dana Carvey took me out of it more than anything. Maybe the Jeff Garlin a little bit too, but
yeah, I thought about like just telling you like, oh, we should just watch this and not even tell you that Dana Carvey was in it, just so you could experience the same surprise that I did. But yeah, but did you like the movie overall?
I did. Yeah, overall, I thought it was pretty enjoyable. You know, it talks about this one little, like I said, this footnote in James Bond history that, like, I think few people don't really know about unless you're a diehard James Bond fan.
Yeah, because I mean, the movie, it doesn't get replayed to the degree that the Connery and the Roger Moore movies do. I mean, because like the Bond movies would play on TV all the freaking time.
Right.
You know, now it's like every once in a while, one of the Turner stations will do a marathon or you see them on TCM or something like that.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, because there's just not as much of a market for the movies on commercial TV anymore. Mm. But I do think his movie is really good and I do enjoy watching it. It's, because the movie, takes place around Christmas time. It has become one of my go-to Christmas movies, which is fun.
Christmas time is here.
Yeah.
On Her Majesty's.
It's just not Christmas until you see James Bond kill some henchmen.
That's right.
And blow up a headquarters and stuff.
That's how I celebrate the Yuletide.
Yeah. So if you have any interest in James Bond, I would recommend seeing this movie. I would definitely recommend seeing Honor Majesty's Secret Service. I think that's definitely worth watching.
Okay. All right. Cool.
If you want a Bond movie that's a little off the beaten path.
Nice. Okay, cool. I will check it out.
Yeah.
Promise. And that's our episode, guys. Thanks for listening, as always, to our podcast. And we're just going to keep on pumping these out through the summertime. Should we let the folks know what we're going to do on the next episode?
We've decided and everything. Let's let them know.
We're going to let you.
People want to know. Yes, Darren Patterson.
All right, we're going to let you guys know because you're such huge fans, and we want to reward our listeners.
You've been good. You listened to that whole 3-hour episode last week.
Yes, this is your treat. This is your reward. So next weekend, Father's Day weekend, we decided we're going to do a movie that came out a year ago called I Love My Dad with Patton Oswalt, Rachel Dratch, Lil-Rel Howery, and others.
Yeah. I don't know too much about this movie. I know the basic premise. I watched the trailer, and it's about a dad who basically like catfishes his son.
Yes.
Because the son doesn't want the dad, Patton Oswalt, in his life. And so Patton Oswalt pretends to be a woman online.
Yeah.
And is like having this romance with his son.
Yeah.
This online courtship to just find out what's going on in his son's life.
Exactly. Sounds kind of fucked up, but I think it's going to be pretty hilarious.
Which is wild. And I is it based on a true story?
Oh, I don't think so. It could be. I don't think so.
I don't know. Well, we'll figure that out. We'll do some investigation on that, and we'll get the whole skinny.
Exactly. So, so tune in next week. I Love My Dad. And
I Love My Dad. Where's that streaming? I know it's streaming somewhere.
That is on Hulu.
It is on Hulu, as is Becoming Bond. So if you have Hulu, you can check both of those things. And I rewatched Honor Majesty's Secret Service yesterday on Amazon Prime. It's streaming on there currently.
So watch all those things. Let us know what you think, guys. And you could let us know your thoughts. Tweet at us at SNL Nerds Show.
Yes.
Or hit up our Patreon at non-productive.com and donate some money to this little podcast of ours. And follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Darren Credible. That's D-A-R-I-N, Credible.
And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram and all that fun stuff at Trumbull Comic. That's T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L and the word comic. And I think we did get a few responses to this week. Yeah, our friends at the Spyhards podcast.
Ooh, wow. I didn't even know that.
I tagged a few James Bond Twitter accounts to see if they had anything to say about becoming Bond. And our friends at the Spyhards podcast says, highly fictionalized and highly funny. A surprisingly frank look at one of the dumbest choices in cinema history. Kudos to Lazenby for putting it all out there, even if some of it is greatly embellished. So,
well, that's...
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment of it.
Yeah, I would say so. It's like... This might not be true. This might be true, but it's an enjoyable all around. It's kind of like a you ever see that movie Confessions of a Dangerous Mind with the Chuck Barris?
No, I know George Clooney directed it. I've always wanted to see that, but I've never gotten to see that. Yeah. I should find out where that's streaming.
Yeah, I really dug it. I remember when it came out in the theaters. Yeah. Me really enjoying it. But I think it's like along those lines where like Chuck Barris, the host of the Gong Show, alleges that he was a spy for the government, a CIA spy, yeah. Exactly. But
you don't know
if it's true or not. But why let the truth get in the way of a good story?
Well, it's like that quote from the man who shot Liberty Valance: "Like when the legend becomes truth, print the legend."
Oh, that's good too. I like that.
If it's a good story, it might be a little more forgiving of it being blatant lies. I don't know how much of this. This movie was true, but I enjoyed the ride.
Yes, absolutely. The fun ride. Fun ride.
It was a fun ride. It was an entertainment. And that's really all I ask for most movies.
Yes.
Just is that you entertain me and you hold my interest for however long. And I hope this podcast helped your interest.
Absolutely.
For this long.
Hope you enjoyed it, fellow listeners.
And if you didn't, too bad.
Yep.
It's done now.
T.S.
So we will see you next week for I Love My Dad with Patton Oswalt and Rachel Dratch. But until then, nerds out!
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.